Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, a new approach to end-of-life care. I'll talk with a certified death midwife who teaches her craft to others. But first, between 1942 and 1966, the Bracero program brought 4.6 million Mexican migrant workers to the United States. Bracero is the Spanish word for manual laborer. And in a few minutes, we'll talk about seasonal workers in Iowa today, but we're going to start with the history of this program. And Brian Binken is an associate professor of history and U.S. Latino studies at Iowa State University. Hello, Brian.
Oh, hello, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And let's go back in time to 1942. Tell me about the environment that really brought about the Bracero program.
Well, sure. Actually, if you don't mind, I'd love to actually go back in time a little
sure.
bit earlier than that. You know, this idea of a guest worker program is it's not really new in the World War II years, and you know, obviously, we still have a conversation about it periodically today. But especially in the World War I years, there was a less formal but similar program, oftentimes referred to by historians as the first Bracero program, that happened in the World War I years. You know, the World War II program is much more formalized; it's better organized. But this is certainly one that when you have those, you know, call them wartime exigencies where you need more workers, you need more people coming in to do jobs that soldiers have left, you know, it does happen periodically. We actually know very little about the World War I program, and it's one of these things that it's, you know, I think it'd be interesting to know more about this precursor program. But the World War II program, obviously, we do know a great deal about, both because of the, you know, the different policies that were put in place, the way the governments, both Mexico and the United States, worked to make the program a reality, and then the fact that many of the Braceros themselves either are still alive and you can go and talk to them about their experiences. Or they've left us, you know, oral recordings, oral histories to tell us a bit about the program as well. But yeah, in the World War II years, the basic story is similar to why you might see or learn about, you know, greater participation of women in the workforce, that men had gone off to fight, especially across the Southwest. There were large numbers of Mexican-American soldiers that had either been drafted or had signed up, and there was a sense that, you know, there simply weren't going to be enough people to tend the fields. And so let's figure out some way to bring more workers in, you know, legally through organized channels to do that farm work. Go ahead. Sorry.
And this was, as you just said, this was designed to be a legal opportunity for workers from Mexico to come to the United States to do this seasonal labor. There were also supposed to be guarantees for those workers to make sure that they were treated fairly, right?
Well, there certainly were. It didn't always work out in that particular way. But, you know, again, this is a governmental program, so you know, unsurprisingly, you're going to have that, you know, that all those bureaucratic mechanisms in place. So, for example, for many years, the minimum wage that I always learned about was $1.25. It may have increased over time, but there was a guaranteed minimum wage. You know, if you were taken ill, you were supposed to be able to either, you know, receive some type of medical treatment or at least have time to recuperate. You know, a basic sort of mandates of how the program was supposed to operate. You know, and these are folks that are signing up in Mexico. They're being vetted in Mexico through the Mexican government, through the American agents that are there. And then when they come to the United States, they're processed in places like El Paso, where they're, you know, checked for you know, they're literally checked to see if they're actual farm workers. I mean, they do things like check their hands to see if their hands have like the the necessary roughness to actually prove that they do, you know, manual labor. There's also some really humiliating aspects where, you know, there's like, you know, delousing and things of that nature where they're stripped naked and you know, basically trying to, the government's trying to make sure that they're not bringing diseases into the country. But yeah, it's got all those mechanisms that you would expect for a public policy, for a bureaucratic program. You know, those are all in place.
Now, the reason that we needed the people to come and work is because so many men in the United States were leaving to go fight. Was this also part of a treaty of allied forces that this was how Mexico was supporting the war effort?
Oh, if it was, I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't know specifically if that would have been, you know, written into that kind of treaty language or whatnot. It is something that is, you know, very clearly and closely worked out between the government of Mexico and that of the United States. And in many cases, actually, it becomes part of what's known at the time as the Good Neighbor Program. It's another one of these things that's also dealt with at the state level. So Texas, for example, has some real problems because workers are discriminated against. Braceros are discriminated against. They are subjected to, you know, the state's Jim Crow segregation laws. And a lot of those workers and their government officials, the embassy officials in Texas, they don't like that. And eventually the Mexican government says, you know, we're going to still send braceros in, but they are not allowed to work in Texas. They actually basically banned Texas from having access to bracero workers. And eventually the state has to pass, or it's not actual legislation. It's a writ from the governor that basically says, you know, we won't discriminate against these workers. Please let us have more of them because we need to put them to work.
When the workers came to the United States, how long were they allowed to stay?
So that's one of the other bureaucratic parts of the program. The period of time usually was 3 to 6 months. The thing that's interesting about it is you could basically re-up at just about any time. One of the things that I show when I teach my students about the program itself is the actual bracero cards that these individuals had. And it's exactly like what you might expect, sort of like think about it as like a combination of like a driver's license and a passport. You know, it's got a picture and it's got your date of birth and sort of basic, you know, biographical information, height, weight, eye color, things of that nature. But also has a place for you to have a stamp that the government, you know, stamps saying you're good until 1951, and now, you know, you want to re-up, and so for another 6 months. Stamp, you know, now you're good to the middle of 1952, whatever the year might
right.
be.
Right. And the workers, when they came, they were not allowed to bring their families.
Right. And that's one of the benefits the actual farm owners, that they see from this particular program. And that's one of the things I wanted to emphasize just a few seconds ago. Was, you know, this is a World War II program, right? So put that sort of with your finger air quotes, right? A World War II program. It's designed originally for the World War II years, but it doesn't end, it doesn't end with the end of World War II.
It doesn't end until 1966.
And one of the things, again, that I show my students that I think is really fascinating is if you look at the years after the end of World War II, that's when you really see the most significant numbers of people coming in as braceros, right? And so it is an advantage. You know, one of the things that Mexican American farm workers protest against is, or that they protest for, I guess I should say, is they would like a minimum wage of $1.25. They see it as really terribly unfair that you have American citizens who are being paid less than, you know, foreign nationals who are coming in as guests. And you know, I think in many ways, they're right about that. But it, you know, it sort of begs the question: is like, well, if you're having to pay these people more, like, where's the economic benefit? I mean, when you get to the bottom line, And part of that benefit is you simply don't have to worry or care about family members. You know, there aren't going to be, these are all men. It's not going to be wives and children. You're not going to have to worry about people like that.
Now, although, of course, guarantees were made, there are allegations of abuse and mistreatment among the braceros who were brought into the United States. What are some of the, in those early decades, I guess, what are some of the things that we've learned about that employers did that took advantage of these men?
Yeah, so I would say we may call them allegations. They happen, right? These are not just people. You know, we now know that the allegations were, in fact, in most cases, a reality. So, you know, there are a number of easy ways in which you can see this. Some of these have been actually documented in photographs. You can actually go and look and say, oh, okay, I can see that, right? It's right there in front of me. So one of the easy ways to see it is with housing. The idea was that these were individuals that were supposed to be given some kind of, you know, decent housing. They never really clarified what that meant. And so what happened to a lot of the braceros, which, mind you, it happened to a lot of migrant farm workers for a number of generations, is they would be housed in barns. We have examples of folks being housed in, you know, what had been chicken coops or pigsties or things of that nature. And, you know, just the kind of substandard aspect of that housing, I think, you know, by today's standards, is probably really offensive to many people. Obviously, when you have people living in a place where chickens or pigs used to live, you know, the prospects for disease or illness, they increase. One of the other things that workers talked about was, in essence, the overwork. You know, they were supposed to work, you know, a regular day, but in many cases, they were worked for much longer. There was a lot of general, you know, racism that the farm owners employed, and then, you know, you couldn't really do anything about it, so you're kind of trapped in the situation.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're learning about the Bracero program, which operated from 1942 to 1966. During that time, 4.6 million Mexican migrant workers came to the United States as part of this program. I'm talking with Brian Binkin. He's an associate professor of history and U.S. Latino studies at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're learning about the history of the Bracero program. It operated from 1942 to 1966, and during that time, 4.6 million Mexican migrant workers came to the United States as part of the program. I'm talking with Brian Binkin. He is an associate professor of history and U.S. Latino studies at Iowa State University. In just a moment, we'll bring Melissa Garcia into the conversation as well from Iowa Workforce Development to talk about seasonal workers in Iowa today. Brian, as you mentioned, this was a World War II era program. It was designed to bring in a labor force that was desperately needed as so many American men went to war. Of course, a lot of women entered the workforce at that same time for that same reason. After World War II, we had a big economic boom. Why did the Bracero program continue at that point as the men came home?
Well, and that's been the kind of good question, I guess, and perhaps it's actually one of the easiest to answer. You know, agribusinesses, you know, and their lobbyists, they figured out that having this kind of government mandated and still captive, program, this captive market of workers, was really, really beneficial. The workers themselves, they worked hard. They didn't, they didn't kind of quote unquote cause problems. They came in and they did their job, for fairly cheaply. And, agribusiness appreciated that. They liked that. You know, for them, it was, economically, it made a great deal of sense. It was easy for them to, you know, to see and want to maintain that benefit. And that's really kind of the bottom line. I mean, these were workers, once again, that were going to come in for a fixed period of time and then leave, unlike, you know, Filipino or Japanese American or Mexican American farm workers. You know, they weren't going to strike. They weren't going to walk off the job. They weren't going to do any of those things. And so today, a number of labor activists, a number of scholars, you know, we kind of look at the Bracero program as in some ways kind of akin to, a massive strike-breaking program, that these are folks that basically kept strikes at bay. So that's the short and simple and dirty answer.
So as time went on, this became more controversial. What began happening?
Well, the program becomes more controversial because of the agency and activism in many cases of those Americans of Mexican descent or of Filipino descent, or, you know, sort of fill in the blank, the people that were also trying to do that same kind of work, who in many cases had done that same kind of work for generations, and who were basically being undercut, you know, by this actual governmental program. You know, as you might expect, they saw it as really terribly unfair, that you can have your own government that is authorizing a program that damages you or hurts you and your community. And so one of the things that we see with the rise of Mexican-American, especially Mexican-American, and you can throw some of these other ethnic communities into the mix as well, when you have the rise of their civil rights activism, you know, that's when you begin to see not just the pushback on the ground, but the government beginning to kind of take a step back and say, yeah, maybe this isn't looking so good for us, or perhaps the benefits aren't quite there in the same way anymore.
And we've talked about some of the abuse of the braceros by employers in the United States, but employers also were discovering that they could hire illegal immigrant labor cheaper than they could hire legal bracero labor, right?
Well, and that had always been the case, as well, you know, where you have, American workers of Mexican descent or an undocumented person, you're always going to be able to take advantage of the undocumented person if you're the employer, you know, in a greater fashion than you will be able to the American citizen. And the same thing happens with the braceros themselves. We don't have hard and fast numbers. There wasn't somebody at the border watching and checking off on a sheet as people came into the country without the proper paperwork. But the estimate is that just as many undocumented immigrants came in at the particular years of the program as those documented people who were a part of the bracero program. And I think I find it interesting on a number of different levels. I find it interesting that, you know, there's so much demand for work that over this period, you can have close to 5 million braceros, but also it seems quite likely that there were at least 5 million people who were not, you know, documented by the program. And then you add to that the actual individuals of American, American citizens of Mexican heritage that are here, you know, the numbers of people that the agribusinesses or the railroads or the mines or whatever it might be need to employ, they're fantastic.
Well, and it's interesting, of course, we still have this push and pull today. Politically speaking, it can be really difficult to get support for a legal migrant worker program because of this conception or this idea that those workers are taking jobs that would be given to Americans or that American citizens would be doing if they were given the opportunity. But it sounds like you're saying there were not American citizens to do those jobs.
Well, no. And, you know, I think as we know, that's really a political canard that has convinced a lot of people that these are, you know, these are individuals coming in to take jobs away from Americans. We say Americans, let's be very clear, we're talking about white Americans primarily that have this kind of mindset that, you know, you're taking a job away that I could have. that's not really true. It doesn't really happen in that particular way. In most cases, these are folks that are doing the jobs that really nobody else wants to do. But it doesn't lessen the power, I guess, of that idea. And it's one of the reasons why, yes, you're absolutely right, that we haven't seen, you know, call it a revised or a 21st century version of the Bracetto program. And, you know, there are lots of ins and outs to why there hasn't been a program again. We could probably have a whole nother show just on that. But, yeah, it hasn't happened.
So we've talked about several elements that were really putting pressure on this program in the late 50s and early 60s. Why did it end in 1966?
And again, that's one of those questions where you can look and the answer is kind of right in your face. It's pretty easy to see. I think most of the credit we have to give to those protesting Mexican American farm workers. You know, these are the years where Cesar Chavez and what started out as the National Farm Workers became the United Farm Workers, were putting a lot of pressure on the government, on growers, on state leaders. And eventually these are folks that are like, you know, why are we're basically courting, problems with an aspect of our workforce that we don't really need to court. And in fact, what they figure out is that, once again, there's sort of that economic bottom line. They figure out that the protests and the boycotts and things of that nature are actually hurting far more than the Bracetto program itself is helping. And so this is, you know, this is the prime reason why, you know, the legislature basically figures out, you know, we probably need to, to get rid of this thing. The situation in Mexico had changed a little bit as well. It's a very complex scenario, but you know, I think if you just put together the Mexican American, the Filipino, the Japanese American workers fighting for their rights, and the growers basically looking and saying, "Geez, how do we keep a stable workforce?" Getting rid of the Bracetto program in some ways is the easiest thing for them to do.
I'm talking with Brian Binkin. He's an associate professor of history and U.S. Latino studies at Iowa State University. And I want to bring Melissa Garcia into the conversation now as we talk about seasonal workers, migrant workers in Iowa today. Melissa Garcia is state monitor advocate and migrant and seasonal farm worker program coordinator at Iowa Workforce Development. Hello, Melissa.
Hello. Good morning. And thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And let's bring us up to the present moment right now, because of course there is a lot of labor that needs to be done on farms every year. It is seasonal. There's a lot of labor, you know, during different times of the year. Give me a picture of seasonal workers coming to Iowa these days.
So in today's day, we have workers that come from California, Texas, Florida to do work in Iowa. We also have workers that live in Iowa that do the seasonal work. But then we also have our foreign labor still that operates under the H-2A program.
And the H-2A program, tell me a little bit more about that. How does that work?
So the H-2A program is a program that allows temporary foreign labor to come into the United States and work on a seasonal basis. It does have to be agriculture. And in Iowa, we see detasseling because we don't have the youth anymore necessarily mm-hmm. that want to do detasseling as much, is what the employers tell us. And then we have also construction on farms. It's a subcategory of agriculture. So we see a lot of construction on farms here in Iowa.
And this sounds very similar to the Bracero program. I mean, give me a little bit of comparison contrast. If somebody applies to be part of the H-2A visa program as an employer, what are their responsibilities?
So there are many similarities. They have the housing provision that the Bracero program had, where they have to provide the free housing. They have transportation provisions where they have to pay for the worker to come and go to and from their country. They have the what they call a three-fourths guarantee. So if the employer has said, "I will bring you to Iowa and give you 40 hours a week," they have to guarantee that they at least get three-fourths of those hours paid during their contract period. It's still seasonal in nature. It's very similar to what we had before. Some of the differences now, for example, the housing. The other gentleman from Iowa State had mentioned that the housing, they house them in very poor conditions. The housing now is more regulated. Our division, my department, actually inspects all the housing for H-2A workers. So we ensure that the workers have a place to live with hot water, with a kitchen. It's sanitary. The capacity meets the regulations, so they're not putting more workers in one building than what they should.
Now, of course, there are still concerns about oversight, about making sure that these workers are not taken advantage of. What are there issues with oversight? What are some of the problems that crop up?
So we do still get complaints. Last year, so I oversee the complaint system for Iowa for all of our migrant and seasonal farm workers and H-2A workers. So we did receive complaints last year, and we still receive the complaint of paid wages not being paid. We also receive complaints on issues of no hot water if we weren't inspecting the property because maybe they're here from another state. Because if you're here from another state, our division doesn't inspect those properties. We only inspect H-2A properties. So if you're here maybe from California and you came with a farm labor contractor, we've gotten complaints before in those instances where there's no hot water in the facility or they weren't paid. Wages being paid is the biggest complaint, and I would say that's the biggest complaint across the nation.
And, of course, there's still this, there's a lot of political controversy about foreign workers in the United States. There always has been. And I want to return to that idea that foreign workers are taking U.S. jobs. Tell me about the process that an employer has to go through to qualify to be part of this program, to bring in foreign workers.
Yeah, definitely. They have to basically prove that there are not domestic workers available for these jobs. So when I say domestic worker, I mean someone that lives in Iowa or even in another state that wants to come to Iowa, but someone that lives in the United States that wants to work these jobs. So when we get the paperwork from the employer, we open up a job order, which is essentially a solicitation for workers in Iowa. You can find it online. You can find it at any of our one-stop offices in Iowa, and you can apply there. And you receive the same provisions as a foreign worker would receive. So if you don't live within commuting distance, you also receive that free housing. You receive that transportation. You receive the same wages as an H-2A worker would receive. So these steps are in place to show that we're not receiving the applications for these positions. Right now, the wage is $13.42 an hour, which is a prevailing wage. It's a wage that is determined every year of what is the most common average wage paid for, let's say, detasseling. And that is the wage that we have to pay the domestic labor or the foreign labor, or the employer has to pay.
Now, Iowa is a place with a lot of seasonal work, and Iowa is also a place with a small population and a low unemployment rate. Compared to other states, what is our demand for workers like this?
So for the last 3 years, it has increased, almost doubling. Right now, this year, we're set to request roughly 3,000 workers for the program. And roughly 200 job orders, which would be the request for workers.
I want to cast your mind back to 2000. The pressure is in Iowa that I mentioned, a small population, an aging population, a lack of workforce in some cases. That prompted Governor Vilsack back in 2000 to propose a program to really encourage migration into Iowa, to encourage immigrant labor to come to Iowa and be a part of our communities. There was a lot of backlash to that. What is the political environment like right now about immigrants coming into Iowa? Because as we know, they're a major part of many of our communities and our state.
The political aspect, I can't really speak to that. I can speak to the employer's needs and what the employers inform me that they need. And we hear from the employers every day that they do not have workers to fill these positions. And without the H-2A workers, their fields would rot and their crops would rot in the field.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yes, thank you.
Melissa Garcia, State Monitor Advocate and Migrant and Seasonal Farm Worker Program Coordinator at Iowa Workforce Development. Brian Binken, before I let you go, this is a program, the Bracero program, that you teach your students about. Why do you think it's important that we know about this program that operated from 1942 to 1966?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know if I have a short, easy answer for it, but I'll give it a stab. I think that one of the things that we see in a class, let's say, about Mexican-American history is the really kind of basic misconceptions that a lot of Iowa students have about who these folks are and why they have either been in the United States or chosen to come to the United States. And talking about the program is one of the ways that you can see that. It tells you about how people are being treated. It tells you something about the nature of the idea of kind of quote-unquote illegal versus legal immigration. These are folks that are part of our history, and so simply understanding that helps us to understand the present.
Brian Binken, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Binken is an associate professor of history and U.S. Latino studies at Iowa State University. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with a certified death midwife who also teaches others her craft. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In recent years, we've seen strides forward in palliative care. That's medical care that focuses on providing relief from the symptoms and stress of serious illness. We've also seen incredible strides in the availability of hospice care, designed to give support and comfort to people in the final phase of a terminal illness. And now there's a new movement in end-of-life care. It's called death midwifery. And my next guest is a death midwife. She also teaches others about death midwifery. Angie Buchanan is based in Wisconsin, but she'll be teaching a 3-day certification class in Iowa next week. Hello, Angie.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Now, first of all, just help us understand what death midwifery is. What does a death midwife do?
Well, we are non-medical helpers that work alongside and in cooperation with the existing medical team. We're holistic and spiritual companions to anyone at the end of life. So we sort of fill the gap between the medical profession and the funeral industry. There's a lot of room in there that just seems to be empty without being paid attention to. And we flow between those rocks of the medical and the funeral industry professions.
Tell me what you saw, what you experienced that made you think this is a place where I can be of assistance and there's a need.
Well, not everyone can deal with being in the presence of someone who is dying or attending to a dead body. It's a gift to be able to stand in that space. And since I was very young, I've been comfortable there, from the deaths of pets as I was growing up to the death of my son in my early 20s. It's been something that I have been able to navigate and to be able to provide comfort and strength during that time for as long as I can remember. And my career has led me into some odd places. I was in law enforcement for a while, and those are the experiences that you have with the deaths that are not necessarily pretty and happening at home and in a hospital. But because of my ability to be present in those spaces, I often found myself being called by colleagues to come and be with them or with a dying loved one, because I was able to be present in that space.
As I mentioned earlier, there have been some pretty tremendous strides forward in end-of-life care, with palliative care, with hospice care. I want you to really describe the gap that you see, as our ideas about death are changing, about our needs at end-of-life are changing. What was the gap? What are the needs that you feel a death midwife needs to fill?
I think, first of all, we need to talk about the idea that there is nothing wrong with death, that it doesn't need to be fixed, and that there are things worse than death. So to be able to face death as the natural end of life is important. We have birth, and then we have life, and then we have death. Death is not the opposite of life. It's the opposite of birth. So for us to recognize that there's a spoiler alert out there, nobody gets out alive, we have become, in a death-denying society, we have become unable to absorb that. And so it becomes almost urgent that we have to focus everything on not dying. And avoiding death is a natural thing, but fear of death is not inherent. It's cultural. So for us to sort of bring that back around where we're not warehousing our dying and turning them completely over to the medical profession until it's time for the funeral industry to step in, we are denying ourselves our final rite of passage. We plan for weddings, we plan for birthdays, graduations, even retirements, and then we act like we're not going to die and we're going to just leave it all to everybody else to handle after we die, which puts an unnecessary financial burden and emotional burden on people who are in a very vulnerable spot because we're not willing to talk about this. And so the idea that we can be present for people in the sacred space of that final exhale, and I would add that no matter what you believe religiously or spiritually, we can all agree that there is a point in time when that final breath happens, that whatever it is that animates us is no more, and we cease to be human. And that space is sacred, and it deserves attention, and it deserves companionship. We come into the world, and we're spoken to softly and wrapped in soft blankets, and the lights are low, and we're held and stroked and cuddled. And why shouldn't that be the way we die?
A lot of what you're saying sounds like what the goal is in hospice care, too. And of course, the hospice workers, there are many volunteers who work in hospice, but there are also nurses and medical professionals who work in hospice as well. What do you offer that is different from that?
There are a couple of things. First of all, hospice is medically prescribed. It's medically sourced, and they're very strictly regulated on what they can do and how they can interact with families. A death midwife can step in at any point in time from first diagnosis or even from being a healthy individual to start helping families do their death plans. So to make sure that they understand what documents they will need in order for their final wishes to be met and to know where to obtain those documents and how to make sure that their plans are in order, how to discuss what it is that they want. And it can be everything from what they want at their funeral services, what readings or poetry or music, to how they want their body disposed of, because most people think that there are just a couple of things that you can do for body disposition, mainly traditional burial or cremation. Green burial is sort of rising to the surface, but a lot of people don't really understand what that means. And traditional burial is completely unsustainable. We're dumping hundreds of thousands of gallons of embalming fluid into our soil and groundwater every year, and it's toxic. Our cemeteries are becoming toxic waste dumps, and it's not sustainable. So there are several new options available and some creative options available for body disposition and some things that people need to know with regard to perhaps maybe someone who wants to donate their body to science. You need to know what the parameters of that are. You can't just simply say, I want to donate my body to Harvard, because maybe Harvard isn't accepting somebody that doesn't have their appendix. So these are the kinds of conversations that we can have with people And in the states where it's permissible, we can guide a family through having a home funeral as opposed to using a funeral home at the cost of many thousands of dollars. We can involve the family in lots of different aspects of keeping their beloved dead at home and caring for them the way that we used to do 125 years ago before embalming in funeral homes became a thing.
You mentioned that a death midwife can come into the process at first diagnosis, but it also sounds to me like these are services that some people might seek before they ever get sick at all in thinking about how they want their own funerals carried out.
Yes, absolutely. And we encourage people to think about this, but also to think about it more than just once. There are lots of considerations. A young couple that came to me recently because they just bought a house and are planning to start a family needed to know what their options were. But 5 years from now, when they have one child, maybe two, and their assets have changed and, you know, things change. So we encourage people to review their documents annually, because people die, people get divorced, assets change, houses get sold. So this is an annual thing, and we have a community that actually comes together and has a document party every year to just go over your documents to make sure that everything is still valid and in order.
So tell me about this certification process. You are called a certified death midwife. Is there actually a national association of death midwives that the certification comes from?
Not yet, but it is in the works. And the idea is we are being guided by the Institute of Credentialing Excellence, which holds the nursing board certifications and licensures and things like that. So that's kind of exciting that they're willing to provide information for us and guide us through this process. But the idea is not to professionalize the field of death midwifery. We're reclaiming it, and we want to protect it. And in the 1990s, the American Medical Association came to massage therapists and essentially said, you're nothing but sex workers, so we're going to take you under our wing and professionalize you, and you're not going to be able to operate as massage therapists unless you're under our umbrella. And massage therapists organized and ended up going back to the American Medical Association and saying, thank you very much, but we're going to self-regulate. And that is the sort of thing that we want to do. We would like to have the parameters of core information that our death midwives will have been educated in. But to keep it as a folkway, a grassroots tradition of compassionate care, so that we can protect ourselves from being absorbed by either the medical profession or the funeral industry, because we're neither.
How long have you been doing this, Angie?
Well, I started doing it as, this is difficult to answer because I've been a death midwife the best part of my life, the better part of my life, and I've always been the one that was there, and I've seen many, many people pass over and been able to be present. But it wasn't until the early 2000s that I discovered the work of Nora Cederwind Young out of Washington State. And she was one of the foremothers of the National Home Funeral Alliance, as well as death midwifery. And so I got to know Nora and ended up bringing her in starting in 2006 to talk about what it was that she was doing. By 2011, I was organizing some specific training programs that she was offering here in my area, bringing her into our area from Washington, and then just continued to do that. I think I had had her here 4 or 5 times by then. And then I received a call in either 2013 or 2014 that she wanted me to come to Washington because she had been given 10 days to live. And I went out there, and she asked me to continue with the teaching, which I agreed to do. Gratefully, thankfully, Nora is still living. And so she did not die as had been her sentence. And but I went ahead and progressed with the training program and developing it into some things that I thought were more helpful and specific, and made it a little bit longer. And so that was kind of how that got started.
So in your work, when you took on this role more formally, was there a moment where you really realized that what you were doing was really making a difference? Can you explain or describe a moment like that to me?
Oh, there are dozens of moments like that. The idea that think of it with birth midwives, you have a birth plan, and you've got somebody that's kind of holding your hand all along the way. It's not just a check-in and you get an hour interview and then you cry on cue for 4-hour increments. And then, you know, medical people come and go and observe and do their testing. This is a companionship, and it is such a comfort to be able to be with a family and to guide them and to let them know that they have options. I think that seeing that family embrace the idea that it's okay to talk about death with the person that's dying. It's okay to be sad. We don't have to deny the fact that this person's leaving, and we don't have to turn their body over to strangers. We can have a home funeral. We can take care of them. We can bathe them. We can caress them. We can wrap our family quilts around them. And we don't have to disappear them behind the curtain because of misinformation. And the misinformation has been that grandma is a public health hazard, and that dead bodies carry disease, and that they decay at rapid pace. These are misconceptions.
Angie, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Angie Buchanan is a death midwife. She's based in Wisconsin, but she'll be teaching a 3-day certification class in Iowa next week. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.